edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. Continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness, I have a terrible admission to make. It's horribly embarrassing, but the other day, I woke up in the morning from a dream, and the last image of the dream was a bored, sullen, monstrous, priapic Donald Trump. And it was a truly horrifying vision that I don't take responsibility for. I do not think I have some kind of unconscious issue with Trump himself. Sometimes you get these collective symptoms appearing in your dreams. And one of my sort of outcomes of that was realizing how much the news cycle and particularly Trump has sort of invaded my mind, and that, you know, it's hard for me to go through the day without checking in with the latest horror, talking about it, reading about it. There's probably never been so much attention on an American president, certainly in my lifetime. And so you get to this point where you realize that even though there's a lot of political issues that we should be paying attention to, tracking, contributing to, participating in, at this point in our rather vexed history, which is in some ways a downward spiral of, modern corporate capital globalism, but that's another story, that we still need to keep ourselves grounded, keep our psyches nurtured with a richer range of encounters than the monster at the top and all of his minions. And for me, one of the best ways to do that is to connect with being in my body, being in nature, being in the outdoors, being in the sensation. You know, I try to take a walk every day. I'm lucky. I live in San Francisco, but I live right by a nice park, so I can go walk up and walk through the eucalyptus trees and kind of get away from it. And it's not so much that, like, nature with a capital N is nurturing my spirit. It's more that when I walk about, you know, sort of not so much in the city, but in the greenery, I can let my sensation open, and there's a kind of bath of engagement with what's actually happening in that space. And some of my opening up to that experience was encouraged by encountering the work of our guest today. Megan Waller Murphy is a wildlife tracker and an ecologist and an educator, and she's super articulate about her practices. You know, there's a lot of people out there who have all sorts of amazing physical practices, ways of engaging the world. They're not necessarily that articulate. And I've known a lot of people in my life who are super articulate and well-read and intelligent, but aren't exactly the most comfortable in the physical domain. And so she's one of those rare birds that can cross those worlds robustly. And so I'm very happy to have her on, and we'll be talking about tracking and related issues. So, Megan, thanks for joining us on the broadcast.
Thank you, Eric. I appreciate the introduction.
Absolutely. So, I thought I'd start. You know, I was looking around your website, and you had this cool little story thing about being a kid. And for me, one of the reasons that I try to make a lot of room for, whether it's backpacking or hiking or camping in the woods or just taking a stroll through parks or whatever, that a lot of the reason it feels sort of reviving for me is that it puts me in touch with being a kid. So I can't imagine that that's not the case for you. So I'd love to hear about when you were young, like the way in which you started to open up to the experiences and attraction to being in the outdoors in a really living, vital way.
Sure. I would say I think all kids and all humans actually begin open, and what happens is we shut down. And so that it seems this tracking or sensual kind of sensory awareness that we're talking about is just inherent to being human or being on the planet, from my perspective. And as a kid, I actually grew up in Los Angeles, so I spend an enormous amount of time in the outdoors now, but I grew up in Santa Monica, right on Manhattan and 12th Street, and at the time, which was all pretty low-income apartment buildings, it's since become very gentrified. And there was, my mom worked days, and she was a single mother, and my dad was over in the San Fernando Valley. So there were huge amounts of time that I had alone with our neighbor friend, and we spent the FUD. You know, TV was not that compelling. It was like Gilligan's Island or whatever, not as enticing as it is now. And it's funny because I hadn't thought about it until I was an adult, but really what we were doing is finding the interstitial spaces between the apartment buildings and in the alleyways. And I thought about it, I'm like, oh, that's just what raccoons do. And when I think about it, you know, we were jumping from like apartment roof to apartment roof, and the trees that are, you know, gratuitously planted between the apartment buildings were where we built our tree house, even though it wasn't our property. You know, we were just renting an apartment somewhere. And so there was all of this relationship with things other than just the construct of the apartment building, you know, and we knew when our neighbors were in the backyard and we had to avoid them because they'd yell at us for being there. And, you know, that kind of takes on the idea of how you're aware of predators and things like that. And so all of that awareness of a kid who's growing up in the wilderness is still had when it's in the city. And it was fun and playful, and you know, you hid. And at one point, I remember we were on this, some shop owner's roof, and he's like, I'm sure you could hear us thundering down there. Came out, and he's like, we're going to call the cops if you cross our roof one more time. And so we stayed up there till the guy left because we were so afraid we were going to get called out and, you know, camped out on the roof. And it gave us this incredible bird's eye view. And at the same time, I would go, you know, I lived part-time with my mom and then the other time with my dad and my stepmom in the San Fernando Valley. And actually, it was called Dirt Road Mulholland, right on the edge of Topanga Canyon. And at that time, I would just go wander the hills. But again, it was a gang of neighborhood kids, and we played, you know, in old lots that hadn't yet been developed, and there were pomegranate trees, and we'd eat the pomegranates and throw them at each other, and you start to learn about foraging really quickly, and you know, rope swings, and you learn when you fall off you break your arm. And so there's this whole body awareness that also comes forward of learning how to move across these landscapes. But again, like, one of the biggest features was moving in between space and be to like larger places without being seen and having to use your senses, because it wasn't so much we were worried about getting in trouble as much as we just didn't want to be caught. You know, it was kind of like if you're caught in tag, or if you're throwing a water balloon at a car, you didn't want to get yelled at, kind of thing.
Yeah, that totally makes sense to me. I wrote a piece, one of the most fun and kind of interestingly provocative pieces I did when in the early 90s, when I was kind of just starting out as a freelancer. I wrote this article about being a teenage stoner, and I started smoking pot when I was 13, and I had all these kind of crazy friends, and I was already doing the kind of stuff you're talking about, but it was really intensified once there was a prohibited activity in the mix.
Right.
And so I wrote this piece, and I talked about the way in which pot, if for us, was like it called us into this interstitial awareness. I didn't use that phrase, but that idea of finding the culverts and the sort of little gaps in the suburban landscape, the canyons, the cracks between homes, the backyards that you could get into from the other side.
Yeah.
And it encouraged this kind of environment. And when the piece came out, I had talked to tons of people, including people who like grew up in New York City, who were like, totally. And it was all about this weird kind of knowledge. And I think you're right that it's like that it's really basic to kids, because even if you're not a stoner, if you've avoided that fate, that's still that desire to play or move through the environments, and that kind of sensation that allows you to be able to see the city in a different way. And I even know people now as an adult who are just better at moving through the city. Like, they have an awareness of the peripheral of these gaps that open up. And it's really key, because it seems to me it points to something that we sometimes miss with the kind of rhetoric around environmentalism and about nature and blah, 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 is that it's always about like this place over there that's different than where we are, as opposed to something that we carry in our bodies, the way in which we actually engage all spaces.
Yeah, I've had the great privilege of when I was still living in Southern California, of working in Compton and Watts and Pacoima with gang kids, specifically men, who just got out of jail or even prison and were still on parole, and I was able to take them out into the wilderness. And I was blown away by how quickly their transition into the wilderness became. Once they got over their initial fear of the unknown, their awareness was so heightened because they were moving through the cities in the way that I move through a place where I know, like, if there's grizzlies or a lion or, you know, something like that, because they're always in that peripheral place and they're always looking in the interstitial spaces because they, you know, when they're walking down the streets in the cities, they're worried about being attacked. So they have this heightened sense of awareness. And so the transition from them, from the city to the wild, was really, really easy versus the kids that were, you know, so-called privileged. It was significantly harder for them to just sink into their awareness and their senses, and it takes a lot longer for them to learn those skills, I found. And it was such an eye-opener in my mid-20s when I saw that. I was like, oh, it actually has nothing to do with where specifically you are as it does is, are you present and are you aware in that moment? And those are kind of the skills.
Yeah, I had a really amazing experience. And I mean, this is just an anecdote, but I'd love to hear your response. Where I have a kid in my family. He came in through a marriage, like a, you know, he's like a step cousin. And he's like totally addicted to video games. Like he's like 17. He plays them all the time. It's his main socializing. You know, he does some physical activity. He's not like a complete shut in, but he's deep into it. And mm-hmm. we went on a trip to Alaska on a boat. And I went out with him one time in a canoe and or kayak. And, you know, and I was like, I was really interested to see how he would be. And what was amazing was he was actually way more observant than I was, because he was used to being in environments and picking out little bits of information that were tucked in the kind of, you know, whatever, you're in a cave and there's something happening over here to the left and you're moving really fast. And I'm sure a lot of kids don't do that. They just don't know how to read the landscape. But in this particular case, he was like looking in, oh, I look at that shellfish. Oh, you know, stuff. And I was mm-hmm. like, shit, I just looked in that area and I didn't see it. And mm-hmm. so it was kind of funny. I mean, in the way of pointing to, even though, of course, there's a lot of problems with the obsession with the screen, and that probably makes it even harder for people to translate to this kind of open sensory awareness into the space that we're talking about. There's even elements deep inside of this kind of artificial world that still are drawing from the same similar kinds of capacities.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love to hear that. I love that they're to see the detail orientedness of playing the games translated to being out in tide pools or in Alaska or something.
Exactly.
And I think what is coming forward for me is this idea of the micro and the macro, right? Like we have the screens and the like kind of frontal lobe thinking and the reading and even driving or writing is all this kind of very intensely focused activity. And what it brings out for me is the detail and the beauty. Like to look at a flower really in detail is a remarkable thing in the world, or a shell, like you were talking about this child you were with. And you start to see like just how intricate things are put together in our natural world. And then there's this idea of scale, of pulling way back and living in the peripheral, like we were kind of started, like in these interstitial spaces and understanding how you move across a landscape. And what I'm finding, and especially now as I'm looking in our political arena, not just in the United States, but around the world, it's this micro, like what's happening right now, even to you in your internal landscape, but your community. And then we pull back and I'm seeing people who are really inflamed, even in their own homes, are inflamed on this, you know, the inflammation on a macro scale around the world right now, whether it's with the refugees or the economics. And I find it really interesting that detail-orientedness that came in through the video games and then you pull way back and you get the scale of what's going on globally too.
Yeah, that's a trip. That's a really interesting way of thinking about it. Well, I want to talk about tracking and you know, the, mm-hmm. And your own like moving into it. But I just want to say one thing that's kind of along these lines is I haven't really done it myself, but I've been with people and you know, backpacking with people who know what they're talking about and can pick things out and, you know, sort of like been absorbed. I've absorbed by secondhand some of the experience, and what really blows me away is the way it kind of in a way combines those modes where mm-hmm. you have to, on the one hand, have this very open perception that you're able to sort of register things that could come from any direction, you know, from the tree over here and from the path or be the broken twig on the bush over there. And you have to have that big space. But then at the same time, you're still, in a way, reading. I mean, it's a different kind of reading, but yeah. It's not just like, oh, I'm away from my left brain. I'm just like fused with nature. It's like, no, you're like, you see these very specific items and you have to read them. You have to tell a story. You have to go, well, look, this is only going to be here. How long would this be here? What is the connection between this and this broken mm-hmm. tree or this scat? What actually happened here? What direction is it going? It's very, you know, it has that left brain quality, but it's embedded in this much more right brain kind of environment. So I'd really love to hear you talk about just kind of what comes out of you as a like a form of consciousness, you know, a form of cognition as you mm-hmm. learn personally to be a tracker.
Yeah. Wow. There's so much.
like, I know.
You're absolutely right. It is reading. It is an art of reading. And there's lots and lots of conversation that has come about that's really where our first letters came from and our first written language came from, these patterns that you're seeing on a landscape. You know, if you're trying to convey what kind of animal you're going after for hunting, you know, to eat, you can etch the words in the sand with the kind of antler shape or the hoof shape, and everybody else knows what that is because in those tracks on the ground, and they've already associated it with a specific kind of antelope, let's say, you know, because tracking really arose in southern Africa and with the Kalahari and the Bushmen and for the need to hunt and for gathering food. And for me, I will just say for me personally, tracking, there's nothing else that has hit me on every level like tracking. As you say, you know, it is a very left brain, this kind of intellectual piece and highly focused piece. And I have to know the weather and I have to understand the botany and who eats what. And so there's kind of this factual dynamic to it. And then it's really quite physical because when I'm following an animal, I'm on my hands and knees for maybe a quarter of a mile, and then I'm trotting after something and I'm up and over the trees. And so there's this whole physical dynamic of total body involvement. And then it's really, really intimate and very emotional. If you can imagine, let's say I'm following a deer for 6 hours, and then you imagine someone following you for 6 hours without you knowing that, and they see everything, right? They see where you slept and what you ate and who you spoke to. And so it becomes this intimate view into the life of something other than human, and compassion arises and deep empathy. And so for me, it's this incredible triad of intellectual, emotional, and physical, or in spiritual, I would lump in with that emotional together. And what I've started to see, so I'm now 20 years deeply, deeply into this tracking practice. And that doesn't include all of the things I was doing while I was a child, you know, I would say since I was about 23, my brain works differently now. I was much more of a linear thinker, probably from going through, you know, high school and a pretty traditional, well, not traditional, but, you know, classroom kind of way that we have now. And it is now, I'm much more circular and integrated in my thinking. You know, the linear patterns don't work for me so much. You would probably, if I was sitting in a classroom right now as a high school, you'd say I was ADD. And really what's happened is it's hard for me to not see the connection everywhere and how everything is influencing everything else. And I actually move, physically move through the world differently. And then just to even drop it in my senses, like everyone's like, wow, your sense of smell, because, and it's not that I'm some kind of superhero. It's just, I work on it. You know, some people work on playing the violin. I work on my, expanding my senses out there. So I hear things that a lot of people just, it's registering to them, but they're just not taking in the awareness that it's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. We've talked about that.
I'm not sure if that's going where you want to go.
No, no. I mean, I'm just, I'm interested in that. That's part of like, because again, I think that there's a, that there's often a problem when people start talking about wildlife and conservation and nature and how we should be better in nature and be aware of it. And all, you know, there's all this kind of an overlay. There's this big story that we've built up in the last 40 years around the environment. And that I think that what people who aren't necessarily deeply into that stuff sometimes miss is all of these kind of very interesting things about consciousness, about experience, about sensation, about how you move your body through the world. There's this whole other domain of it that's not so much about fetishizing the wildlife or fetishizing with wilderness, whatever exactly that is, especially in our world now. And it feels like to be an environmentalist is partly about transforming your sensation and the way you move through the world always. And it has to do with attention and being having that diffuse attention that's capable of being extremely exacting very quickly. So you can get focus going very quickly, but there's also this kind of ambient openness. And I usually do it mostly through sound, and I'm not that, I don't know that much about botany and things like that. I'm not, you know, that smart. I'm not that smart a wilderness explorer, but I have like been really interested in developing this kind of capacity to sense and notice changes in weather, smell, very distant sound. And for me, that's part of being a natural being as well as a, you know, cultural character. But one thing I could ask you about I've heard you talk a little bit about is some of the experiences you've had where you with learning this with meeting trackers, whether they're in Africa or in the hills of California, you know, where you were really kind of, you had the blessing to see what happened to another life that was devoted to this, maybe in a very different situation than your own, and what kind of people they were. I'd love to hear about, you know, one or two.
Yeah, I mean, so I feel really fortunate that I've had many incredible teachers. And I think what we see a lot also in the tracking world, and the tracker people are most familiar with in the United States, is Tom Brown. And I think what happens is you kind of get this idea of the cult of personality, or like you were saying, fetishizing. And people try and emulate and mimic what Tom Brown's tracking journey was. And, you know, I took one class from him and he didn't even show up in the class. And so I had this great fortune of being able to learn from many different teachers. And of course, you know, as a young tracker, I was like, oh, I'm going to be like this person or whatever. But the more diversity that I started having with amongst my teachers, I saw that all of their tracking journeys were really unique. And they were all just doing it in their own way, which all of a sudden gave me this freedom to realize, oh, my tracking journey is going to be my own. And the way in which I approach this art and skill of tracking is going to look really different for me than it did from my mentors. One of my greatest, most significant teachers was Dr. James Halfpenny. He's a carnivore biologist, and he is up in Gardner, Montana, and Yellowstone. And what he has brought to me about bears is just phenomenal. And I would say my tracking journey and with bears is, that can be a whole different conversation, but his deep, deep love for the animals, and then also overlaying it with this scientific mind, has been just such a gift of the integration between them. And even just this last summer in June, I was up in Yellowstone with him, and he teaches a class that is the like anatomy and botany and physiology of bears, tied in with the archetypes and the stories and the native legends of the bears, you know. And it's so beautiful to look at the whole picture, and it doesn't have to be either or. You know, everyone wants to romanticize the wolves, but, you know, they're really intense creatures and they do cause havoc, and I love them, and I've also watched them kill things really brutally. And so I think that dynamic that James has taught me is to really, how do you embrace and encompass the whole being, right? Rather than just leaning to one side of what I would like it to be, but to really see the whole being there. And
That's a good, so talk a little, just because you brought it up, and I'm fascinated, but bears are just totally in my imagination, and I have been blessed to see them a couple times. I'm big guys out in the wild. What were some of the things about tracking bears? What do you learn? What is the challenge? What's the specific kind of, what's the texture of that tracking when you're dealing with a bear?
Yeah. So, I mean, what's so interesting about bears, and I have had the opportunity to see this, is when, if you, for whatever reason, need to skin a bear, to see it, if it didn't have its head on, it actually has the exact same structure as a human skeleton and musculature. And indigenous people in the Northern Hemisphere, where there are bears, and there are some in South America as well, have known this for as long as they have been living with bears. And so there's this incredible overlap in relationship of humans with bears. And every culture that I have been in that lives with bears and is still living close to the land sees the bears as healers, and not necessarily in that kind of, oh, I'm going to heal one individual person, but they were like the healers of the land and the healers of community and culture, like these kind of big, broader pieces that they would hold. So that in itself is really fascinating to me. But to be more on the tracking part, they leave, for being such enormous animals, they leave a very subtle trail. You know, they are flat-footed like us. Their footprint looks very, very similar. Their hind footprint to ours, it's just a little bit wider. They also have five toes like us. And surprisingly, you know, you would think you would see their tracks more, but you don't. So in tracking them, there's all these kind of subtle energies that come up and nuances. And the first time I remember, and this was, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago, I was in Coyama Valley, which is in the hill. It's the high desert behind Ojai off of Highway 33 in Southern California. And I had a bear kind of run in front of my car. And I had a few hours free, so I pulled over and I was like, oh, I want to look at these tracks that were in the gravel, or not gravel, but kind of soft dirt substrate, and I'll just follow the bear, you know? And so I had the opportunity to find these just really subtle claw marks, even though it was a 100-pound bear that probably about that went in front of me. And I got on his or her trail. I never caught up with it. And I could not believe that I was going through spaces that would be like the size of a round serving dish, you know, and these bears were just snaking through this brush and shrubbery in such amazing ways. And this bear was not quiet, but the trail that it left was so, had I not seen the bear there, I would have never known a bear had crossed through that place. You know, it was pretty incredible. And the reason I ended up stopping following the bear is because when I came to it, to this one point under these oak trees, and the duff was really deep, what bears do is they create these, some people call them traditional trails or step-by-step trails or stomp trails. But when a bear crosses in those areas, whether it made the trail itself or not, it will change its stride size to deliberately step in the footsteps of other bears that have walked there before. And no one really understands why that is. And I can, they're pretty incredible. So I want
to. That's amazing.
So
that's a great example of of the way in which, you know, your actual experience, you know, you're following these traces, these signs that are left, you know, and they're very challenging and this and that. But as you're doing that, you're also getting a kind of more intuitive or multidimensional impression of this particular mm-hmm. species, a character, a quality, a flavor, something that is unique to bareness and how they are in the world, that you're kind of, you know, getting along with the specific signs that you're tracking.
Exactly. And to follow a coyote is very, very different. And you start to drop into the coyote's world because they're moving, they move usually in pairs, and they're much more fluid, and they make these like helixes with each other and figure eights with each other as they travel over the land. And a deer again has another character. And so to follow these animals, really gives you a deep relationship with something other than humans, which is, to me, really compelling right now. You know, I work and teach. Did you want to go ahead, or should I keep?
No, I was just going to ask you more about that, about what about right now makes that kind of relationship even more precious and important.
Yeah, so I work with the Santa Rosa Junior College, and I teach quite a few adults. And right now in our political times, I have a lot of people asking me, you know, how do they show up and what can they do to activate, and what does activism look like for them? And so, and I, for myself, have been really pondering this question in our political climate. And I keep coming back to, you know, I'm trying not to be biased with it, but it feels so important to me right now that people begin to develop a relationship with the land. And it can be a small piece of land, you know, in your local park or wherever it is. And I, you know, I start to think about, like, what if Congress or Trump or whichever side of the fence you're on actually had a relationship with a tree or a lizard, you know, and you start to begin to build empathy. And then a Muslim doesn't look so different. And a wall doesn't become as important, and a Republican is not so scary, and we start to develop relationships with other things, and our compassion grows enormously. And it's not a quick fix, you know, and I think that's part of how we got here, is that people are wanting these very quick remedies and fixes. And to me, what seems so important is to really develop relationships so that not necessarily agreement arises, but respect arises. And I see this over and over again, as you began, in our media, is that lack of respect or integrity is missing. And I think it's because we're missing that relationship with things that are different and other than ourselves.
Yeah, that's a big one. That's a tall order. And how do you see people responding to that? Like when you talk about these ideas, and people maybe who have lives that they don't have as many opportunities to be out there, they don't have the habit or whatever. How do people rise to that challenge? How do you see people responding positively to that kind of call out?
You know, I see people as one. It's some people are really excited about that because they feel like, oh, it's something I can do. You know, and then there's people, and including myself, like, is that really enough? You know, comes up. And I don't think it's so much of having the opportunity to go out, because I think you can cultivate that awareness that we're talking about in relationship, even in your office buildings, or, you know, like this practice that we're talking about of this sensory awareness and in relationship with other, you know, I can sit in a bar and do it at the bar room and figure out, oh, right, there's, you know, there's a wooden bar here, and that was a tree, and here's a person that I don't normally talk to, and how do I somehow, I don't even have to engage with him, but how do I actually cultivate more tolerance for that person? And so I don't let, you know, people are like, oh, I don't get to go outside so much. That to me is too easy of a way out. You know, I'm a little bit rough there. I'm like, yeah, you can work it a little more than that. And I think it's also scary because it's not a language that is used anymore. You know, I think even 200 years ago, but certainly 500 years ago, all around the world, that understanding of being in relationship with even soil or the trees or the plants you were cultivating or walking through, or to be in relationship with a deer or a bird, was not so magical and mystical. I think it was a much more everyday occurrence, and it's since waned from our culture and art language hugely. And when I, you know, when I track in Africa and Southern Africa, that relationship is still alive. Or, you know, 2 years ago I was in the Congo and had the ability to track with gorillas, and what we call magical is commonplace. And I don't, you know, and I'm sure it existed here in the United States. I think it's just been quashed by all of the other things that are going on.
This raises a really interesting question for me in terms of, we've talked about the magical and the mystical, and I've talked about the kind of romantic ideas about environmentalism that we've had in the last, you know, since those, let's say the early 70s, 1970. And one of the ways that the environmental movement has proceeded is through a kind of appeal to that desire for enchantment, for mystery, for mysticism, for oneness with nature, for the opposite to the life of being a, you know, somebody working and reading and being in a kind of cognitive, you know, cultural universe. It was like another place where you could go and blah, blah, blah. And there was a lot of, you know, John Muir being like the king of the guy who went out and by himself in the Sierras and wrote these ecstatic books of extraordinary prose. But, you know, he was also a naturalist. He also knew what he was doing. But that's part of the appeal of the environment, has been using that kind of desire for enchantment. But we're at this weird place now where, and I'm really curious to hear how you see it, where there's in some ways the romantic ideas of wilderness and so whatever are kind of actually in the way of a lot of things that need to happen, yeah. At least where I see it, and I think you do too. And yeah. At the same time, the desire for that enchantment is legitimate, and the sense that it also that it does lie in a relationship with the broader physical, biological environment is true. It you do get some of what you're. I mean, I've had those desires too when I was a kid. It was probably why I smoked pot. I liked this feeling of enchantment, and now I've discovered I can do that just with my body in a park.
Exactly.
But so there's this weird thing about the the romance. Is it good? Is it bad? And how do you see now a kind of need for a different way of articulating how we turn to nature, which is such a kind of crappy word in some ways, to how we turn to nature for this sort, for our own kind of needs for a kind of broader view, a more enchanted view, and at the same time respecting the realities and the harsh realities in some ways of the situation now, and sort of integrating more left brain into that process so it somehow it does something different than it's been doing. I know it's a little vague question, but I'd love to hear your riff on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm understanding what you're getting at, and just a little bit of history. So, you know, when the first Europeans came, there was a lot of records, both on the East Coast and over here in the West Coast, of how park-like the landscape looked and how well tended it looked, and there was never any recognition that the indigenous people living on a landscape, wherever that may have been, they were actually working with and managing in part of their environment, just in the same way that a beaver comes in and cuts down a tree, or an elephant in South Africa is, you know, knocking off branches and basically pruning them. There is all of this, what we call disturbance happening, and we were part of that process. But because of, you know, colonials coming in and seeing the savages, it was totally negated that they were actually interacting or had the knowledge of working within the system. And then we came in and there was this, I'm going to talk about colonial. And so the colonial people saw this vast, incredible landscape with abundant wilderness. You know, it would take 3 days for the passenger pigeons to fly overhead. I mean, even in the Bay Area, they talk about the Canada geese and the waterfowl going over and blackening the sky for hours. And the, you know, we all know this horrible tale of the bison and on and on. And so it was like, oh, this is an infinite resource and we will use it as we want. And so then, you know, there was this massive extractive policy that went on, and that went on well into the early 1900s, you know, so we're talking like 200, 300 years of extraction of the resources here. And then, you know, 1950s, 1960s, Rachel Carson, all of this, we were like, oh, we can't continue to do this. And so the environmental movement swung to this, we often hear it called the leave no trace policy, or, you know, hands off, don't touch it, preserve it. And to me, that's like, okay, put it in a jar and seal it. And so it swung from one side of the pendulum to the other side of the pendulum. And in there, there was not the recognition going all the way back that actually humans are part of the system and we're an integral part of the system and we need to reinsert ourselves back into the system. But that only works with this, what we're talking about, this slowing down and awareness and watching and talking to our elders, right? And certainly the indigenous elders are really important. Find your native people where they are and talk to them and honor them. But also the, you know, there's, five generations of farmers living in Sonoma County that I chat with, and they know how the land moves and they remember the salmon stories and things like that. And figuring out how do we reinsert ourselves and how do we begin processes that were so integral to the health of our ecosystem. And it's not a hands-off policy at all. It is not a leave no trace policy because we left lots and lots of traces. When I do a traditional walk with the Sierra Miwok and the Mono Paiute, and we do their trade route, and we go from Yosemite Village over to Mono Basin one year, and then you go the next direction the other year. And there's a Mono Paiute man who's also a botanist who works for the BLM in Nevada. And when I walk across the landscape with him and he's reflecting to me what he sees, he said, you know, it looks messy to me. It looks untended, unkept. And what I have learned through tracking and through following these animals and understanding how they are actually leaving a trace every time they go somewhere, right? That's how I can follow them, is that I feel like our ecosystem, our ecology, our place is waiting for us, like with bated breath, to reinsert ourselves and be in relationship again. You know, it's like as soon as you take an elephant off a landscape, everything feels and reels from that. And it's like we have taken ourselves, which is a species, out of the system, and we are seeing the effects of that.
Yeah, that's
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, because that's then it just raises the next question. How do you do that without this just repeating the extractive, practices of the past?
Exactly. And so that's the crux of how do we do that? And I think that's where we call it, because this knowledge is still alive. It still comes, we're talking about awareness and subconsciousness and things like that. Like, I dream of plants. Like, there are songs that I have dreamed of in plants, and then I brought them to people, and they're like, oh, we remember that song. And I had not been taught it. And so there's this kind of inherent earth wisdom that I think arises from people, the more and more you allow yourself to pattern on that, pattern in nature. But there is just a wealth of knowledge and incredible resources of people, especially in California, who are working to bring back this eco-literacy. There's an incredible book called Tending the Wild by M. Kat Anderson. She is a PhD professor at UC Davis. And her book, her PhD, was basically about looking at management practices of indigenous people. And she went out there with a digging stick and realized the more that she was out there and working with these certain plants with the digging stick, which are edible bulbs, they grew more fecund and they had more diversity and they were larger bulbs. And so she then spent the next, 15 years gathering stories about all of these different land wisdoms and practices. And it's an incredible book. And it's becoming a manual, basically, from land management in much of California. There was another book that actually came out in the 1970s that I found in a used bookstore, and it was titled Native Americans Working for Biodiversity. And it was all about the practices all around the United States, of indigenous people working to create diversity. And there's lots of examples of that, and I'd be happy to send you a list and you can post it somewhere. But I think it's about, the only way that I know about, it's about education and people really spending the time to know this if they want to, and how do we get the word out?
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Is that, now, would you say that those, that kind of interaction with the landscape, that kind of tending, how does that relate to the idea that we talked about before of the sort of pattern literacy, of the way you're learning to kind of read the landscape? Are there seems like there's a relationship there.
There absolutely is a relationship. You know, the way that at least I understand that the indigenous people understood that was because they were slowing down to learn the patterns and to watch the patterns, you know, to understand what is best for the oaks and how fire, you know, how the oaks respond to fire and how fire becomes this keystone process in woodlands. And so, again, we're coming back to this idea that I don't believe any of these solutions are fast. I think really what it takes is for us to slow down. And I think that's really scary, you know, because there's a lot of people really ramping up and speeding up. And there's this fear of like, oh, if we slow down, the other side will win. And I just can't get behind it, because as soon as I start to speed up and I start to lose my pattern literacy and my awareness, or even my ability to see the patterns of the other side, because I'm moving as fast as they are, you kind of lose the edge and I become what I most abhor. And so it is right now my greatest challenge of how do I slow down and trust that there is action in that. And
yeah.
Action. And it's scary for me because I'm a go, go, go.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I can only assume that, that in your, you know, dealings with farmers and trackers and hunters and, you know, people who are learning these things, you know, you also are in a place where you're crossing over people of, at least in an American context, you know, very different political persuasions. You know, you're probably, I can only assume that you've had very robust relationships with people who are in some ways deeply on the red side. And I would be kind of curious, like how the sense of the land or how it shifts or how your own experiences of people who are, you know, have Republican values but take the land very seriously. They know the land very much, but they have maybe a different way of thinking about it in terms of the government, blah, blah, blah. Because it seems like one of the things that's happening right now, and I've been thinking a lot about it in my life, is that whatever you say you want to happen and not happen, like I'm not going to get in that, whatever else is going on, that people who have the capacity of being robustly with people that are not who they agree with, whether it's people being able to handle, an Iraqi family moving in down the street, or in my case, and probably your case, being able to sit down with someone who's really, you know, fully Republican at this moment, and still be able to have a conversation where you don't just degenerate into Twitter storms and just, you know, repeating the same media crap. And so I can only imagine that you've been kind of mapping this zone a little bit, and I don't know if you've had sense of a kind of place of possibility there, or ways that your views have shifted around this.
Yeah, so absolutely. I work with a lot of people who support Trump. Well, actually, let me restate that. I don't know anyone who really likes that man or supports him. I do know a lot of people who voted for him because the other options were too scary. And there's also a lot of suffering going on in the center of our country that I think certainly the bubble of California and North Bay is not totally aware of. And I've had a really great opportunity to work in Colorado with ranchers and frackers out there, doing watershed restoration and mammal tracking research projects, and in other places in the country. And I am one most appreciative of those people who are ranchers and have lived on the land for 50, 60, 70 years, because when I go out there, they know the stories of what has happened, and they know the history, and they know what chemicals have been sprayed where, and where there used to be elk, and where the landslide was that closed off this calving ground. And that's incredible information that I could never hold, right? Because I'm not there. And I think often what I see in the environmental movement is those people, because they're deemed as ranchers or something like that, their environmental knowledge is often overlooked or taken for granted. And it seems to me a huge blind sight in the environmental movement. And it makes me quite sad for that. And the other thing that I've really realized in working in that kind of climate and area is that their livelihood is significantly more tied to their resource, to their land resources, than ours is, in the cities and whatnot. And so, ironically, they're much more aware of the environmental impacts of the weather and things like that, because their cows die, or their grass doesn't grow, or their crops don't come in, or they've been flooded out. And their livelihood then is completely gone. And so one of the instances, I was on a road trip, I guess it was last winter, and we got stuck in Rock Springs, Wyoming, we were driving from Montana down to Colorado, and there's a big snowstorm. And so we were driving around the town just looking for something to do. And, a third of every shop was closed, and it was a pretty desolate town. And there was a sheep and livestock and saddlery shop that was open. So my partner and I, we went in there and we start talking to the owners. And they had been born in Rock Springs, but then the two brothers had moved to San Anselmo. And the one whom I was speaking with, he was actually a trash collector for the city of San Francisco. And he said he had to move out because he just couldn't stand the arrogance of the Bay Area. And then he moved back to Rock Springs and started this business. And so I was asking him about all the closed shops. And he said, well, we had a town of 50,000, and it was something like, no, they had a town of 25,000, and they had lost 10,000 jobs in 2015 because of the move to solar. And so all of their economy had all of a sudden collapsed. And in 2016, they lost another 6,000. So right there, it's over half their population of their town and their community was gone. And he said, the solar industry and the wind industry, sure, but people don't realize how much actually comes from oil. And he wasn't so angry about renewable energy, but more so about the lack of understanding of the impacts of what those choices mean. And I know certainly within my circles, there's people like, oh, we have to do this and we have to change to this. And we have to make sure that we're only using renewable energy. And yes, I think that's a great solution. But I feel like there's a lack of connection to the people that are on the other end of that decision. And again, it comes back to having relationship with others. So as soon as I understand what it means to take away 15,000 jobs where people are now homeless and hungry, I have greater compassion about changing over from oil to solar energy. And it doesn't mean that I don't think we should, but now how do we do it in a good way that's supporting everyone? Because right now, a lot of what's happening is these rash decisions are being made and one side of the equation is being left with nothing.
Yeah.
So tremendous compassion. And it makes perfect sense to me why Trump got elected, because there's a lot of people who are hurting because of rash decisions where not all sides were considered.
Yeah, very much. That's good. Those are good words. We got about about five minutes left here, and I didn't know if you wanted to put in a little word for the salmon. I know one of your projects, yeah. Local projects, is working on salmon in the Russian River. And I'm just so curious if you got that coming out or still working on that.
So I do. A year or two ago, let me preface it. So 5 years ago, I moved up to Sonoma County, and I'd never lived anywhere that had salmon. And within a month or two, I was dreaming of salmon, and everywhere I went, it was salmon this and salmon that. And I just felt like I was being courted by the salmon. And then it turned into a full blown out love affair with these incredible totemic species. And so I started just anywhere I could go to learn more about it. I started reaching out to biologists, and I started going, walking all the watersheds and talking to water people and reading old stories and finding out what the indigenous people knew about salmon. And so I wrote a historical ecology of salmon in the Russian River. And I finished that book about 2 years ago. And one of the most profound things for me and my love of wildlife and animals and nature is that you just you know, we can think of them as other, but you can't really. We're completely inextricably intertwined with them. And what became really clear to me, specifically with the coho salmon in my watershed, is, you know, they are the indicator species of water health, bottom line. And if there's no water, there's no salmon, you know, and if there's no salmon, you should be really afraid of what's going on with your water. And so the salmon were a gateway for me to getting even more deeply intertwined with water and the water systems of certainly my own life, but of my watershed, my community, our state, and then globally. And after I wrote that book, I actually did a writing exercise of a year of every day writing about water, and wherever I found it, whatever my thoughts were, reading stories about it. And it was profound to go that deeply into a relationship with water. And so
that's great. That's great. So that book's out.
Yep, that book is out, and I think you can buy it on Amazon, or you can email me and get it through me.
Wonderful. And then, do you consider yourself kind of a just a last final thought, a citizen scientist? Do you kind of relate with that concept that people are talking about a lot these days?
I do. I think they're, yeah, absolutely. So that idea of reuniting people with what's going on in their areas to gather data or not. What I found is that most people don't want to go outdoors unless they have a purpose or a reason. And so what happens with citizen science is you say, oh, I need some help. Like, I have a wildlife camera project going on right now. And so I'm like, oh, I need some help with my wildlife cameras. And so now they have this purpose to go outside and they go set up the cameras and whatnot. But what I see happens intrinsically is that the more people are going out, that purpose becomes less important. And what becomes more important is just going outside and having a relationship. And they start to notice that the water is changing every time they go to this place to get the camera, and they notice the trees and, oh, now there's this tracks. And so I think citizen science is a gateway for people to start building the relationships that we're talking about.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's a well thought out. So you invite people to participate in some of the projects you're doing. Maybe you can tell your website so people want to get in touch with you, even though, you know, they might not be living in Sonoma County. But
yeah. So my website is meganwallamurphy.com, and it's meganwallamurphy.com. And on there are a lot of the different projects I'm working on, and you're welcome to contact me. And there's also an events page. I do teach tracking through different nonprofits. I also have a Western Women's Tracking Conference coming up in May, where a bunch of incredible women come together, and we certainly do a lot of wildlife tracking, but we also work at tracking our internal landscapes and really dropping into our body sense and awareness. And of course, it's intertwined with art and lots of really yummy food.
Wow, that sounds pretty awesome.
That's super
great.
Fun.
All right. Well, Megan, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Eric. I appreciate the invitation.
Great, great. So that was Megan Walla Murphy. And until next week, folks, keep your minds open.
FM, your source for progressive radio that makes a difference. Hello, everybody. I'm Bhavani, and I'm the host of I Eat Green with Bhavani every Thursday at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week, I discuss food issues in the news, share a recipe, and interview someone in the food, health, or environmental arenas. And I invite you to join me, and you can listen either live every Thursday at 10 a.m., or you can now access my archives directly by dialing 1-701-719-0880. Please listen in or download me at another time by going into prn.fm and finding me in the archives. Again, this is Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Hope to hear from you soon.
This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and I'm the host of What Women Must Know every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. As a naturopathic doctor and psychotherapist, I am always seeking the latest solutions to help you rejuvenate and regenerate your body, mind, and spirit. So join me, Dr. Cheryl, and my inspiring guests, authors, health practitioners, and wise elders, to empower yourself by expanding your knowledge about your health and your hormones, and to gain fresh new perspectives on life. That's What Women Must Know every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Progressive Radio Network. The Thinking Person Station.
Hey, it's Paul Capelcante, host of The Vinyl Experience, bringing you a new spin on a classic technology that just keeps getting bigger. Vinyl records are in, and The Vinyl Experience is the original radio show that tells their backstory, one revolution at a time. Join me Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM and anytime in the archives.
Crackle, crackle. Pop, pop.
The Vinyl Experience on PRN.FM.